Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hello, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, rescue me from me and all that I believe. I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and our regular host, Jonathan Strickland, is not with us today. He is still out on vacation.
Yes, but he's having lovely adventures. In his absence, we went on a very short Billy Corgan impersonation kit there.
I hope Noel was not recording that.
I kind of hope he was. It was really delightful. Both of you do a really good Smashing Pumpkins.
Anyway. Thank you, Lauren. Thank you. So today we're going to be talking about a fascinating topic in genetics.
Yes.
But we want to get there in a kind of roundabout way by talking about islands.
Yeah, we want to get there via the Galapagos.
Have you ever been to the Galapagos?
I have not. Have you?
No, I haven't, but I want to go there someday.
I know. It's lovely. There's so many things there that you literally cannot find anywhere else, and not like restaurants, like beautiful wildlife.
Yeah. I mean, the restaurant scene there is probably not what people go for.
I don't think it is, no.
Yeah, so you're probably familiar, but just in case you're not, the Galapagos are a group of islands, or more accurately, a volcanic archipelago in the Pacific Ocean, about 1,000 kilometers off the west coast of Ecuador, right along the equator. I think it actually straddles the equator.
Yeah.
And the Galapagos appear to have been mostly uninhabited before the Spanish visited in the 16th century, by humans, that is.
The Galapagos Islands are situated more or less smack in the middle of these three conjoining tectonic plates, and thus three different ocean currents, meaning that over the millennia, lots of critters from all over the world have wound up there, and the ones that stayed and reproduced branched off from their ancestors due to the unique living conditions and separation from the general population.
Yeah, and for this reason, today, the Galapagos, I think, are mainly known for their wildlife. That's why people mostly want to go to this place.
Yeah.
So you've got, for example, the endemic Galapagos penguin, the Galapagos giant tortoise, and there are a few subspecies of that, like the saddleback tortoise and the dome tortoise. And then, of course, those smug, insufferable marine iguanas.
Did a marine iguana from Galapagos, like, wrong you in your past?
You know, I would never advise anybody treat them with anything but the utmost respect for nature, but just look at their faces.
Ah.
They just look like jerks.
They do. You know,
sitting on those rocks,
so
they look really proud.
And slappable. Yeah, there's something about them.
No, do not slap an iguana.
Never slap an iguana. Why would you do that?
The Galapagos, they've got all these animals that are very beautiful and unique and iconic in many ways. For one reason, I think, because the Galapagos were, this archipelago was one of the places that Charles Darwin stopped on his voyage on the HMS Beagle.
Famously, yes.
Yeah, and so I think for that reason they've become sort of emblematic of animal evolution and ecology in many ways since then. And like I said, I've never been, but I've always heard that because of the lack of large natural predators on the island, many of its animals are just very friendly.
Just chill. Yeah. They're fine, basically, with humans hanging out around them.
Yeah, and they'll allow you to approach them without running away. So that can be very wonderful if you are a peaceful, conservation-minded ecological tourist who wants to visit the island and see some animals. Not so great for the animals if you are, say, a pirate or a whaler or something that wants to kill a tortoise and eat it for its meat, which has figured into the island's history.
Or save it for, or harvest it for its beautiful shell or et cetera. Sure.
Exactly. So these days the Galapagos they're sort of a popular wildlife and conservation tourist destination. But the archipelago's beautiful and fascinating endemic species aren't the only critters on this island group today.
Yeah, because if you know anything about sea travel, especially sea travel in prior centuries, humans weren't the only things on these ships.
Right. There is a rodent problem, or has been a rodent problem, in the Galapagos.
Mm-hmm.
And so according to the Galapagos Conservancy, the brown rat, Rattus norvegicus, and the black rat, Rattus rattus, they were introduced to the Galapagos probably in the 17th or 18th centuries by seafaring visitors like whalers and privateers. And as you alluded to, this is not an unusual story. Wherever humans go, various rodents tag along with us. They're mm-hmm. sort of like, you know, when you see a shark swimming and it's got those little things hanging onto the bottom side of it and they just go along with it?
Yeah, yeah. The barnacles that live on whales that whales sometimes use as big battering rams in whale battles.
Yeah, so if we're the shark, those things are rodents. They just come along with us.
Yeah, they're just hanging out.
Because humans create a lot of trash. I think that actually is one of the reasons. But
yeah.
Like many other cases where organisms are introduced by humans to new ecosystems that haven't evolved to accommodate them, they haven't always been there, the native organisms can really suffer. And this has been the case over the centuries with introduced rats and mice in the Galapagos. Many native organisms, especially birds and reptiles, have been severely threatened by these rodents, which tend to prey on their eggs and their young.
We've talked a bunch of times before on the show about these invasive species and the kind of damage that they can do because, nothing evolved on that island to protect itself from this sort of threat.
Exactly. So the Galapagos giant tortoise is one example. So the giant tortoise has been severely threatened on multiple islands by introduced animals, including rats, for one thing. Though historically, we would be remiss if we didn't also mention, as I alluded to a minute ago, the role humans played in more directly reducing those tortoise populations themselves through, for example, hunting and, I don't know whether you'd say this is direct or indirect, I guess indirect through habitat destruction.
Sure.
So the tortoise's eggs and their hatchlings have been preyed upon by animals like rats, especially rats, so badly that on the island of Pinzone, scientists believe that until just a couple years ago, there had been no new tortoise hatchlings in about 150 years.
Oof.
Yeah, exactly. So conservationists did come up with plans for ways to get around that, and some of their plans actually did succeed. For example, decades-old conservation efforts focused on breeding tortoises in captivity and keeping them there until the young tortoises were about 4 or 5 years old, at which point they became too large for the rats to prey on them, referred to in the literature as being, quote, rat-proof.
Rat-proof tortoises.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, scientists.
You'd think the shell would make them always rat-proof, but I guess rats are crafty.
I guess, yeah. Well, and when the tiny little baby tortoises are you know, too small, or I don't know,
no,
are their shells too
never
squidgy?
Mind. I don't want to imagine
this
the
is
details.
Very sad. Okay.
So that did help. But even with this measure in place, the tortoise eggs would be threatened in the wild. So the problem was bad enough that conservationists trying to save the tortoises began a program to eradicate the invasive rats in 2012 through mass poisoning with rat bait, essentially.
And, yay, poison!
But so far, it does seem to have worked. In January 2015, there was a letter to Nature where a group of scientists and conservationists confirmed that in December of the previous year, so December 2015, 10 saddleback giant tortoise hatchlings had been found on Pinzone Island, and they believe that if they saw these, there must be more that they haven't found. And this was the first time hatchlings, as we said, have been observed in the wild in more than 150 years. And so it suggests that the animals are finally able to recover their population through natural breeding, not breeding in captivity.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. I have less good news to report.
Yeah.
Just over the past month or so, sadly, in May to June of 2016, news broke of the first confirmed extinction of a bird species on Galapagos. And the bird in question, which is the San Cristobal vermilion flycatcher, I'm not going to try the Latin because I didn't practice it before the show. Birds of this type had been seen in the wild since 1987, so they were presumed to be extinct already. But this news comes after a genealogical and morphological review marked the bird as being its own species instead of just a subspecies, as it was previously assumed to be.
And what caused this extinction?
Rats.
Yeah.
I mean, rats mostly. Eating the eggs, and also a parasitic fly that kills chicks when they do manage to grow to hatch. So bad times for this vermilion flycatcher, and they're really pretty is the sad thing.
Yeah.
They're just brilliant little scarlet-colored birds. Anyway.
That is sad, though even we should always remember that even the ugly creatures should have a right to live as well.
Deserve a good shake, yeah, absolutely. And now there are lots of other vermilion flycatchers of various species and subspecies on the island, but lots of them are also in decline. And there's really interesting work being done in studying the birds' individual island-based adaptations, because different islands within the archipelago have different environments. And so you can really get into the genetics of how they adapted and broke off from each other within those populations. But it's a situation where researchers are basically scrambling to study the birds before they all disappear.
Yeah.
They're hoping that a few more species can be and subspecies can be distinctified and identified, but they might not if we can't start controlling this rat population.
Yeah, and so this is sort of a model of an issue that goes on around the world where small island populations of endemic animals are threatened by invasive species that humans bring along with them when they travel to these islands. So in many cases, island wildlife conservationists have been able to make some progress saving endemic species by eradicating invasive populations through totally conventional means, poisoning, traps, etc. But none of those methods are ideal when you lay out, you know, thousands of pounds of rat poison. You can just guess that that's not the thing you want to do most to the natural ecology.
Or even traps that other animals could blunder on into. Sure.
Mm-hmm. And also these methods are just difficult to use. Like, they can be expensive, labor intensive to carry out.
Mm-hmm.
And so our question today, inspired by some recent stories in the news on this subject, is could we use a different method to try to eliminate invasive species on islands?
A more forward-thinking method?
Possibly. The method in question is what's known as a gene drive.
A gene drive.
Right.
Does this have to do with, like, donating denim?
I think when I was talking to my wife Rachel about this last night, she made the exact same joke.
Yes. Yeah. High fives to Rachel.
Yeah. not worded the same way, but it was pants themed. So what are gene drives? Well, let's say that...
Forward thinking. It was pants themed.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It sometimes is.
So what are gene drives?
Well, let's say you want to spread an engineered gene throughout a population of animals. One commonly discussed example is that of a mosquito with a gene that prevents it from carrying the malaria parasite.
This is a thing that basically everyone can agree would be A+.
Exactly. I mean, it would be a life-saving innovation on a massive worldwide scale. If mosquitoes can't carry the malaria parasite and transmit it to humans, just enormous amounts of mortality and human misery around the world could be prevented.
If you do not remember, mosquitoes actually are the creature that kill the most humans, perhaps other than humans, every year.
Indirectly, by being the carriers.
I guess it's the malaria parasite, but
yeah.
And screw that parasite. Anyway, so...
It's really bad, but yeah, so if you can create a mosquito in the lab with a gene that says, sorry, malaria parasite can't survive in me, I won't transmit it, that would be great, but then you face another problem. Let's say you've created this mosquito. How do you get that mosquito to become the new mosquito, to take over wild mosquito populations?
Mm-hmm. Because just releasing a single creature, but even a large number of creatures into the wild doesn't necessarily mean that their genetics will propagate out over an entire population.
Right. So let's look at what happens. I mean, how do sexually reproducing animals get their genes? Usually what happens is that a male and female mate and their offspring each receive 50% of each parent's genes. You get a recombinant mix of the two,
mm-hmm.
mostly at random. So in the case of each gene location in the chromosomes, you have a 50% chance of inheriting the allele from your mom and a 50% chance of getting the allele from your dad. So if this anti-malaria mosquito manages to mate, half of its offspring will carry the anti-malaria gene. And of the ones that do carry it, only half of their offspring will carry it. There's this population genetics barrier to the spread of this anti-malaria technology. And this is assuming that the trait has a neutral effect on survival and reproduction, or even confers an advantage, so that the carrier mosquitoes have more offspring than the non-carriers.
That's not guaranteed.
Right.
It could be in some way detrimental to the continuation of the species, to reproducibility.
Exactly. So if it's detrimental, we can probably expect it to dwindle and eventually disappear. Even if it's beneficial, it's only going to spread very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to might become widespread among mosquitoes in the long run, but it'll take a really long time, and it's still not guaranteed. So if you want to be sure that it does become widespread among wild mosquitoes, you'd have to release just an absolutely gargantuan number of engineered mosquito individuals into the wild with this gene, and that's not a great plan either.
That doesn't sound like a fun way to spend my Saturday.
Yeah. Like if somebody comes to you and says, hey, we're going to release 500 trillion engineered mosquitoes into...
Want to help?
Yeah. into your neighborhood.
I'd be like, no.
Thanks, yeah. So this is where the gene drive comes in. So a gene drive is a system for biasing the inheritance of genes. That is pretty simple. But the goal is toward altering an entire interbreeding population in a short amount of time. So at the microscopic level, the gene drive is literally just a heritable molecular mechanism, like a tiny molecule machine that's attached to your DNA that gets passed on from parent to offspring and ensures that a selected gene will be inherited with a near 100% certainty during sexual reproduction.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about that mechanism in a minute, but let's just give kind of an example of how this flows out to a population.
Okay, so again, let's imagine that you want to use a gene drive to spread this anti-malaria gene among a wild population of mosquitoes. We can assume for the sake of an example that the mosquito that mates produces four offspring that are able to reproduce into the next generation. This is not based on real mosquito brood numbers.
No.
I just picked a random number and it was four.
Four is a nice easy one to multiply.
Okay.
So yes.
So with half of them inheriting the gene on average, 100% of them or close to it will inherit the anti-malaria gene. So now each of those four offspring all reproduce and all of their offspring carry the anti-malaria gene. And the gene drive ensures continued inheritance. So then you've got 16 in the next generation. And then if each of them has four offspring, you've got 64, and then 256, and then 1,024, and then 4,096, and then 16,384. And by the 16th generation, you have over a billion individual carriers of this gene.
And so, okay, how this molecular mechanism works at a high level, because I am not a geneticist, it's actually a genetic power that is already seen in nature. There's this so-called selfish genetic type of element, of gene element. Okay, so these genetic elements don't follow the usual law of averages of genetic inheritance. When an egg is fertilized and one of the parent's DNA contains a selfish element, that genetic bit targets the other parent's parallel allele, the other genetic bit, and alters it.
Ah.
So, zip zoom, in this fertilized egg, you've got just about a 100% heritable trait.
Hmm.
The tricky bit here is taking the genes that make a selfish element and attaching them to the trait that you want to absolutely make sure gets passed on, this anti-malaria trait, for example. And, okay, science has been working on that part for over a decade, but it's been really rough going until our discovery of CRISPR and Cas9 came along over the past couple years. And we did a whole episode about how that whole genetic toolkit works in April of 2015. The episode is called Editing Genes with CRISPR, if you would like to go check it out. But in brief, CRISPR is another natural genetic process. It's part of some bacteria's adaptive immune system. So if a bacteria fights off, a bacterium, pardon me, fights off a particular virus, the CRISPR system will neatly snip out a wee bit of that virus's DNA, a sort of fingerprint or like a wanted poster, you can think of it. And the system then attaches that snippet of DNA back into the bacterium's own DNA. So it keeps kind of like a catalog that it can refer back to. So if another virus with that bit of DNA ever comes knocking at the bacterium's outer cell wall again, it will know immediately that the virus is bad news and can defend itself by dismantling part of the virus's DNA using a protein called Cas9 to do the manual labor. The bacterium can pass on its wanted catalog to its offspring because it's part of its genetic code. So that is a super great way for bacteria to live longer and better.
It's an amazing microscopic machine.
It is. It is. And it's also super useful to us because one of the things that we've struggled with most in genetics classically has been how labor-intensive and expensive it was to cut and paste DNA together.
Mm-hmm.
But researchers figured out a way to apply the CRISPR system to target basically any DNA they want, which means it's hella easy now to physically isolate and remove bits of genetic code and also to insert them into other bits of genetic code.
Yeah, certainly relevant or relative to what it was before.
Absolutely. So you take this selfish element system and you combine it with our knowledge of the CRISPR cut and paste system, and huzzah, you can pretty easily design a gene that will drive itself through a population just about as fast as that population can propagate.
Yeah, and depending on the reproductive schedule of the organism in question, it can work with astonishing speed. Like, I've seen predictions that with a method like this, scientists could stop the spread of malaria to humans within a couple years.
Oof.
Whether or not these predictions are true, the gene drive is obviously an amazingly powerful tool for altering nature with a very low initial investment.
Yeah.
But if we want to come back to the problem that we started discussing at the beginning of the episode, like invasive species on islands, how would you use a gene drive to fight a problem like this? Because in this case, the goal is not modifying an organism so that it does something different, like doesn't become a disease vector. But the modification that we want is just something that would eradicate the species.
Oh, sure. Well, and in that case, really, the modification that you want is something that does not reproduce.
Right. So it turns out it's not very hard to dream up a gene that, if delivered through a gene drive, can steer a population into extinction. In fact, it seems pretty easy. So let's say you have an island with a rat problem,
mm-hmm.
and the rats are driving natural endemic species to extinction. Here's the most common solution that scientists have come up with. You establish a gene drive for a trait that causes all of an animal's offspring to be male, or a vastly biased portion of them to be male.
Right.
Imagine how this works on an island. With each generation, males make up a more disproportionate contingent of the total population until eventually there are virtually no females for them to breed with and the rats stop reproducing and disappear. Your rat problem on this island is gone.
Yay.
So there are some pros and cons to this method.
Maybe yay?
Yeah, pros to this method. You don't need poison or traps. No need to dump thousands of pounds of rat poison out of helicopters all over the entire island and maybe accidentally poison other organisms or set out traps that people have to collect and that, you know, you maybe accidentally end up killing some of the animals you were trying to save.
Or getting your toe stuck in. Yeah, none of that.
Right.
Good times.
Another possible pro is that, a lot of the people who would be doing this eradication are probably animal lovers. It's not like they want the rats to suffer. They're just trying to keep native populations from going extinct. So this could be seen as a more humane way to eradicate invasive species. Instead of poisoning them, killing them painfully,
mm-hmm.
you just allow them to live out their lives without being able to make more of them.
They're very sexually frustrated lives.
Yeah.
But yes, other than that, it's definitely much more humane than poison.
Yeah, I'd probably agree that that's true. But what if a reproduction-prohibiting gene drive were to get loose in a non-isolated population? Because the way it works on the island is it just keeps multiplying. This gene spreads through more and more of the population until there's nothing left, and
mm-hmm.
then the rats die off. What if rats carrying this gene got to the mainland?
What if they hitchhike on the sharks that are humanity and get back over?
Whoops, because then they could breed
uh-huh.
with rats on the mainland and essentially start this entire process over, except for the entire world. That's not good, because you could accidentally create worldwide extinction, and as much as we don't like rats, I don't think we want to drive them to worldwide extinction.
There would certainly be other repercussions involved there. As again, we have talked about before on this show, any time that you interrupt an ecosystem, it's going to have wide ripples that you can't really predict, because ecosystems are so complex and convoluted. The other con that I just wanted to mention because of me is that this is literally one of the things that led to everyone except Jeff Goldblum and I guess a few other people dying in Jurassic Park. because all the dinosaurs were female and no one remembered that the frogs that they used the genetic code from to help build the dinosaurs could switch sexes when the population lagged. And, okay, look, what I'm saying is not that introducing gene drives into a population of rats is going to lead to all of us getting eaten or hunted for sport or whatever by dinosaurs. I'm just saying, you know, I mean, do you want to do the line, Joe?
Life finds a way.
That thing right there.
It certainly does. It smashes through barriers painfully, maybe sometimes even dangerously, but there it is. And though I think about Jurassic Park now, and it seems that they had it backwards.
Right.
So if they were trying to produce a population of animals that couldn't breed, and then they had all females, it seems like just one male could really mess up that whole system. What they
right.
should have done is have a population of all males.
Yeah.
Then if you had just one female get in there, that wouldn't be good, but it wouldn't, you know,
wouldn't
have a runaway effect.
Absolutely. I think the reason that they did it that way, the explanation for this plot hole was that it's easier to turn off genetically the male chromosome
yeah.
than it is to, because all embryos
yeah.
start as females. So.
They did the easy thing instead of the smart thing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know?
And created a gaping plot hole.
other general thoughts about gene drives. I mean, we should definitely end by emphasizing, I think, the concerns and very serious caution that people are saying we should exercise with this technology for very good reason.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because it is so exciting. Like, the concept is so dynamic and interesting. But also, yeah, like, this is one that basically every researcher that I've read anything from who is working with gene drives right now is mm-hmm. like, let's apply some
yeah.
great safety brakes
yes.
for a while, y'all.
This is one of the most powerful and one of the scariest tools we've ever invented, I
yeah.
think. So what could gene drives do besides halting the spread of disease through vector modification or eradicating invasive species? I'm sure we could actually come up with tons of different ways to apply a technology like
oh,
this.
Sure.
Here's one I thought of that might be released into the wild. I don't know why I said I thought of this. This is one I read about. I wasn't trying to claim credit there. What it was herbicide-pesticide resistance, reversal.
Mm-hmm.
So often organisms that hamper crop development, like weeds and insect pests, for instance, develop resistance to the safest chemical means of keeping them off our food crops. One example, weeds resistant to the herbicide glyphosate. So with gene drives, you could spread a gene ensuring vulnerability to conventional herbicides among the wild population, not eradicating them, just essentially undoing the resistance that they've evolved to the poisons we use to keep them off of our food.
And that could help us as a side effect, or not a side effect, like as a cascade effect, minimize the different types of herbicides and pesticides that are used, focusing on the ones with the fewest side effects, which
yeah.
would be real good times for other creatures that interact with those herbicides and pesticides that are not as hardy. Like, say, bees.
Yeah, you don't want to be constantly upping the potency of your arsenal to protect your crops because
right.
upping that potency probably is just doing more and more damage.
Sure. And, you know, so, or I don't know, like maybe we could use a similar, we could use the technology to make bees more resistant to those poisons, although that seems like more poisons, I think, is not the point of all of this. I did want to put in that it would, though, be harder to propagate a gene drive through most crop populations themselves because most crops don't reproduce sexually. And this is perhaps obviously, but it should be stated, a technology that only works in sexually reproducing populations. A lot of crops are made by very controlled seed populations.
Oh, like cloning, essentially?
Yeah,
in
totally.
Plants.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think I actually knew that fact. That's interesting.
Yeah, a lot of cuttings are used,
yeah.
which is essentially a way of cloning.
That
so,
makes sense.
Yeah.
Another question I know people are wondering about. Could humans be eradicated via a gene drive?
An important question.
So technically,
one that's relevant to me.
If nobody was paying attention and you had a really, really long time to do it, I guess, but in reality, probably not, because gene drives rely on fast reproductive cycles to spread through wild populations. And humans and other large mammals that have multi-year reproductive cycles would take centuries before the gene drive became widespread. And by then, we would probably have detected the problem and done something about it.
Sure.
So I wouldn't – that's not the big worry. But does that mean we should not worry? No. This is something we need to be incredibly cautious and concerned about, because so maybe they won't affect us, but could gene drives released into the wild cause some very bad outcomes that affect other animals and affect us indirectly? Absolutely. This is a very powerful and very potentially dangerous technology, and among any sexually reproducing species with rapid generational turnover, a gene drive accidentally released into the wild could cause worldwide alteration or extinction.
And possibly in ways that we cannot imagine, you know, because genes do sometimes jump from one species to another, from one phylum to another. There's lots of examples of that out in nature.
Yeah, so what if, for example, you have... usually we see the dividing line between species as being, you know, animals that won't naturally interbreed with one another. But sometimes animals do cross the line, and it can surprise us.
Yeah. So for those reasons, some scientists are recommending that for any gene drive designed, a either reversal drive or an immunization drive be designed in parallel. A reversal drive would act against the original drive, cutting it out of the population if something started to go wrong. And an immunization drive would spread through the population alongside the original drive, preventing later generations from inheriting the original, which, you know, wouldn't stop all of the potential damage, but it would certainly limit it.
Yeah. One thing I have heard, one of the sort of glimmers of hope, is that you could potentially just design an antidote drive, essentially.
Exactly.
That's what I think you're talking about.
Yeah, with the reversal drive. Sure.
Yeah. So it's not like if it got loose, there's nothing we know we could do to stop it. But that doesn't mean we should be cavalier about it either.
Yeah. And researchers, furthermore, are working on a way to cut off gene drives after a few generations, like naturally in the wild, by designing in a sort of fail-safe. A team out of MIT specifically has conceptualized a daisy chain effect, is what they're calling it. And the idea is this: okay, you split the genetic information that you're testing into three packages. Part A can only paste itself into wild DNA if part B is present. Part B, meanwhile, can only paste itself into wild DNA if part C is present. And part C, here's the critical part, is a normal old gene that will only be inherited about 50% of the time. So, if you release creatures with all three parts into a natural population, the next generation will all have A and B, but only about half of them will have C. So, although the gene drive will persist out for a few generations, eventually part C will largely die out, and then B, and then A. And this could allow for a safer way to introduce a localized, temporary gene drive into the wild.
Interesting.
Hypothetically.
Yeah.
If it works as planned.
Right.
If life does not find a way.
Right. So, yeah, don't run away with any of this thinking like, oh, we're
oh,
okay
perfect.
Then. Don't
Let's
need
go.
To worry about that.
Do it tomorrow.
This is something you should be thinking about and everybody should be paying attention to. Because it's yet another one of these things where recent advances in genetics, I think, are catching people off guard. They're coming faster than people are coming up with ways to form ethical opinions about them.
Largely because of this CRISPR process, which is, I mean, super amazing, but also, has just pulled entirely the brakes off of the system, really, in terms of what we can do with genetics.
Yeah. And so I think we should definitely pay heed to the scientists who are urging caution and very careful treading on this. I'm not necessarily opposed to gene drive research. I think it's a good thing to be studying, but it's the kind of thing that you have to study extremely carefully. So, you know, what if you're just working on gene drive research and you've got a lab full of insects and one of them escapes the lab? Whoops.
Oops.
There have been, I know people have tried different methods of controlling this, like, for example, only experimenting with gene drives in organisms in labs that are in places where those organisms don't naturally live. So if one did escape, somehow it wouldn't find anything to breed with.
Sure. Yes. And send all the gene drives to the polar south and don't experiment on penguins at all.
Yeah.
Are penguins in the polars? I don't remember. I always get this mixed up.
I think they're on the water.
Okay. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yes. Caution.
Yeah, exactly. So
I mean, it's really cool. It's really cool, but caution.
Yeah. Anyway, there's been a bunch of writing about this in the science press lately, and it's something that's definitely worth keeping up with. I would just recommend Googling gene drives and news around this subject if you want to keep abreast of this developing topic.
Yeah. If you have any specific questions about it, then feel free to ask us.
Yeah.
You can get in touch with us in multiple ways. Our email address, if you're still into that email thing, is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. You can also reach out to us on social media. We are on Twitter and Facebook, where our handle, strangely enough, is also fwthinking. We hope to hear from you. We have enjoyed talking about this, and you'll hear from us again very soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.